I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson.
And we are a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar mitzvah.
So welcome to our podcast episode number 49.
But who's counting?
I am.
Are you now?
I am. This is the podcast where we wrestle with deep questions such as, well, we have Paul's letters, but what about his emails?
Well, it depends if it was a church private email line.
We know that he used a private server, though. So, right. Rome, if you're listening.
And they are.
If you can find Paul's 30,000 emails, I'm sure you'll be greatly rewarded.
Well, the Pope's in on it. I mean, it's the Pentaverant.
Ah, yes.
The Rothschilds, the Gettys, and Colonel Sanders.
41
tits up. I can't remember. There were probably other ones. The Pope.
The Pope, yeah.
The Rothschilds. That's a great movie for all the millennials.
And our sponsors, Men of the Beard, Beard Oil.
I like how you segue from Mike Myers' Scottish accent to whatever the hell that was.
Yeah. Well, Virgil came.
Southern Jew.
My whiskey. We have whiskey.
It's the robber baron goodness.
Yeah. Please. Low country whiskey. And of course, the Pipe and Pint, as always, the one on Spring Garden in Greensboro.
It's a landmark.
The lovely Larry Christopher and Peppy Pete Pike.
Peppy Pete Pike sounds like a bad Hanna-Barbera character, like the Amazing. Not, what was it? The Amazing Race or the?
Oh yeah.
It was just, right, this, yeah. Let's just throw all the shit characters with the three you know, and we'll just have them driving a never-ending race. Which actually has a better premise than Speed Racer when I was a kid, because I can get that shit when I was old enough to get it. And if Virgil Caine's listening, they need to send us some of that ginger stuff they've been brewing.
Yeah.
Or distilling.
Yeah.
Making.
Yeah, distilling. You just
love crafting.
Yeah, please do. Especially in the fall.
I follow on Instagram License to Distill.
Okay.
And they featured a few cocktails with Virgil Caine in it. Mm-hmm. But so, like, the newest thing I've noticed in craft cocktails is somehow incorporating smoke, either into the glass before you pour the liqueur in and all that. And I'm thinking, well, shit, we're ahead of the curve by a good 20 years for me.
Yeah, just inhaling the cigar, exhale just as you're bringing the glass
this,
up.
This is, yeah.
You're there.
These are for people that just, you know, can't be bothered to smoke a good cigar. I think we can safely say I got some good swag today, Charles. I followed through your recommendation. I'll hold off on the one you're going to be smoking. I got the Viaje Ghost Pepper, which you raved about. And Viaje does good stuff, although, honest to God, the wrapper, it just looks like a tampon. But, you know.
Well, the label wrapper, not the wrapper of the cigar.
No,
you want to make that distinction,
for whatever, yeah, we'll post a picture of it. It's ridiculous. But I... on your recommendation, and it wasn't, you didn't have to work too bloody hard.
No, because all I had to say was three little letters.
LFD. So I got an LFD, and it's Lido Gomez, so you know it's all kinds of good Dominican Puro tobacco. And this one is the 15th anniversary edition created just for the Pipe and Pint.
Isn't that the one on Spring Garden?
Yes. And they only made 200 boxes of these things, so there's only 2,000 cigars of this make in circulation.
Well, 1,000
of them are probably upstairs at the Pipe and Pint on Spring Garden,
and 500 of them have already been smoked, I'm sure.
Oh, God, I know, I've smoked so a few good. Of them. I mean, it's the 15th anniversary. It has kind of this rich coffee bean type color to the wrapper, and I'm reading this from Cigar Coop, who is local, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Cigar reviewer, and we what we like about him is he doesn't work for anybody.
Right,
you know, he buys his own cigars. So I mean,
which we're trying not to do.
Right, right. But it's just got lovely, you know, color to it. You know, some tooth, but not too much. It's oily, of course it is. It's an LFD pigtail top, but I've already cut through, and it is a nice tight box press. I mean, just when I took the pre-light draw, you know that when it tastes good, and you ain't even fired it up yet. You're going to be in for a treat. I mean, you got some leather notes, some coffee, and cedar spice. And this just kind of has gone through. Apparently, the whole cigar is filled with that. Even has some cream notes to it. But as you know, it's LFD, so pepper is going to be the lead note in it. But this is lovely. And The only thing I can find online was that this is really, really old tobacco.
It was old before they made the cigars. Yeah, it was aged. Yeah, yeah.
But you had the other one.
I had the other one, and this was on Larry's.
In honor of the opioid epidemic, Charles chose.
Yeah, chose a cigar based on heroin. It was actually Larry's recommendation, and after all, he is my pusher and my supplier. But Esteban Carreras.
Of Chupacabra fame.
Chupacabra fame and a cigar that we enjoyed. This is the Mr. Brownstone.
Yeah, good Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction album.
You're right, and I have the Vitola the Smack.
You get this. go ahead and explain to because I didn't get the reference until
my first thought, is Guns N' Roses. It's a heroin reference, and so the Vitolas are, instead of Toro and Corona, you know, you can get a Speedball, a Smack, or Mainline.
The Mainline was, what, 60 by 6?
Yeah.
It was like, I can't put that in my mouth and feel entirely not Freudian. I don't have that much time.
Yeah, and it's a quick podcast. But Connecticut Broadleaf wrapper, beautiful brown, little, not really toothy, just a few veins, but nice and oily. Ecuadorian Habano binder and Nicaraguan filler. The red pepper hits you right off the bat, and then it just blends out into beautiful cocoa, coffee, earth, and a touch of citrus. It's definitely a full strength cigar, which is not surprising coming from Esteban Carreras. It's not that he's known for them, but when he does a full-strength cigar, he does a full-strength cigar. Well-constructed, as always, and wouldn't put it as the most complex cigar. You get all the flavors, and they kind of mingle at times. It doesn't really go through a whole lot of changes, but it's just that good, earthy coffee, cocoa, and this, every once in a while that pepper comes in and out.
See, I thought I was going to be nice jealous, job. But honestly, I could care less what you're smoking at this point. This is Charles, again, Larry, Pete, keep up the good work.
Lito.
Well, Lito didn't need a pat on the back. He's number one cigar of the year last year.
Yeah.
And for all we know, 2017 may be in his grasp as well. How does it compare to the Chupacabra, though? Because that's like the only thing I've really smoked significantly.
A lot more pepper than the Chupacabra. Okay, and a little bit more citrus. It has the same cocoa and coffee in there that you got in the Chupacabra, and probably even a little fuller.
Wow! They can't see me make that puzzled like
he's a little fuller.
You know, dog look in my
fuller than the Chupacabra. Yeah.
So is this like? You know what? I'm going to back up.
Okay.
I want you to note my restraint and my restraining my child last week. I mean, with Georgia and Florida and, you know, a close one.
Appreciate you.
I didn't.
Yeah.
And I guess the same way I restrained my wife, it was a lot more fun doing that.
Well, that's between you and her. There are places.
It was.
You know, that's illegal in 6 states.
Are we in one of those states?
No.
Oh, well then.
Okay. Yes. You're fine. Yeah. It's mainly Minnesota, Utah, and South Carolina. So.
Oh, no, the state of South Carolina, we're talking about laws. They have more prisons than public universities in the state of South Carolina.
That explains a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So maybe
it was a total tangent.
Why Will Muschamp went there after he left Florida.
Well, I felt for you, and I felt guilty because I started, you know, just pulling for your teams because you're not a Tar Heel fan, so I don't have to hate you. Like the Jewish Christian divide, I can work with.
Sorry for me.
Right. But I feel that my pulling for them and the Dolphins and I just wouldn't mention any other sports teams you like because
Well, considering the fact that the entirety of your sports knowledge is Duke basketball.
If you're going to do it right. We've got 6 players that are candidates for Player of the Year at their positions. That's a first even for the Blue Devils, and it's the 13th season in a row we're preseason number one.
Yeah,
I mean it hasn't translated into but only 3 national titles in that time. But you know,
okay. All right,
not too bad.
And Florida is in the top 10 this year.
Yeah,
ahead of North Carolina, by the way.
Well, North Carolina's going to take a dive because with Joel Berry breaking his hand.
I know. Yeah, well, they did. I mean, they're down at nine.
I've also started watching, you know, because we had Jenna Reback.
Yeah.
Of Bad Jew Weekly. And mm-hmm. So now I'm like watching Stanford scores just to see if I can rub it in, the, you know. And
well, I sent her when the top 10 came out because she was bugging me that.
Well, she asked with basketball. Last week's podcast.
You know, Duke and Stanford are great basketball. I'm like, yeah, and which one of the three of our teams is not in the top 25? Well,
and I'm sitting and I'm wondering if I know Johnny Dawkins used to coach at Stanford, but I'm assuming he's probably been moved on somewhere else. Right. But for a while, you know, Duke coached there too. We should probably talk about something more interesting, like, you know, we could talk about a lot of things. Terrorist attack this week.
Yeah.
We've had, of course, Halloween.
Halloween. Well, I was going to talk about with Halloween. We're a little slow. Let's face it.
Oh yeah, we are.
And the week before, 2 weeks before Halloween, we had Phil Wyman, the Welsh troubadour, who lives in the Halloween capital of the world, Salem, Mass. And then we had Jenna Reback, who.
Reback.
I was thinking shoes for some reason.
She's going to send you some nasty tweets.
Yeah, she is.
Swear to God.
Yeah.
Brilliant woman. Just really enjoyed meeting her online and talking.
Yeah. Well, she just did her Halloween.
She did. She did.
The one. But what's interesting is that you had tweeted this topic on Monday.
I did.
And we hadn't been able to get to it until now. So even though it's past Halloween...
500th anniversary of the Reformation.
Yeah, and that one, we're going to do something special for that.
Along the lines of, if the Reformation worked, why are there still Protestants and Catholics?
Right, and we're just going to invite a lot of people to come in and you know, so phone in and Zoom.
Right, so it's going to be a room full of Methodists and you.
Yeah.
Most of your contacts are either Methodists or defunct Methodists.
Right, well, there's a few Pentecostals and some Church of Christ.
Do we got any Catholics?
Yes.
We do?
Yes.
We have a Catholic. We could do a Gentile, a rabbi, and a priest.
And guess how we found this priest?
Oh, he's probably through your wife.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. That's dead easy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious who it is.
Now, I have guesses, but...
Yeah, you're probably wrong. Anyway, so we're going to do demons and ghosts and dibbics and ibbers and golems.
Oh, my.
Yeah. You know.
I knew several of those words. The ibbers. I think they lived next to my grandparents when I was growing up, but golems,
They get around. A dibbic.
Is it like a doppelganger type thing?
No.
Oh.
It's more like a dibbic. Yeah. So, you know, because we're... one of your favorite expressions about depression...
Oh, yeah.
...is that... You know, it's dopamine and not demons. It's serotonin and not Satan. And so we had a question from someone who's been following our blog posts.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the eighth person that's read the blog.
Well, I read them six times.
Well, not us. You read them once. Not us. Etric Creations, and I'm sorry if I butchered that. He has a... We'll maybe post a link to this. It was actually in response to one of my ECT posts, the first of in that series. And I'll just read his statement to us. I, too, have spent years on the medi-go-round. I like that. That cracked me up right there. That, you know, dosing and titrating and of psychiatric meds and the weight. And I, too, have finally agreed to ECT, which is good for him. And God bless him that it works. What I want to ask you about, however, is the opinion so often voiced that if I had more faith, I would have better mental health. How do you negotiate such conversations? So my initial response, although I didn't type it that way, was tell him the fuck off.
Well, I was going to say, the way you negotiate those conversations is
I turn around and walk the other way.
With a sledgehammer.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know what? If it does good for your health and it's working, fuck what anybody else thinks.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm sorry.
And if they get offended, you can just chalk it up to... or your whatever.
We could go into like the more apologetic arguments, which I did put out there. I did quote my Jew with the what I think is one of the best illustrations of the collaborative method of spiritual recovery and coping, is that you got to meet God halfway. If you're going to pray to win the lottery, you got to buy a ticket. But, you know, what it kind of got me to, though, and I'd been reading in my coursework and all about various case studies, and when people present as psychiatric patients, and they have sort of religious imagery and metaphor, and they're communicating using that, or they believe that their condition is somehow supernaturally, to use a very broad term, impacted or created or what have you. In my own family, that, you know, people, well-meaning people, over, mm-hmm. I feel now, yeah, in hindsight, over-spiritualized my depression as being, well, it's demonic, you're possessed.
Right, you're possessed.
And we can go into,
or inflicted.
So that's kind of where we're going with this, rather than the what to say to people that said, well, if you just pray harder. And I've had parishioners over the years that I've told, like, you keep that up, and while it's good for you, you'll bury whoever it is you're praying for so hard. I mean, it's,
or you can say, well, I have been praying hard, but apparently not hard enough because your head hasn't exploded yet.
Was it Nadia Bowles Weber? Like, you know, whenever God, you know, which is Julie Andrews and Sound of Music. Whenever God closes a door, God opens a window. And her response to this day cracks me up. And if I can find that window, I'm pushing your ass right out it. Loved that one.
Yeah.
So that's the setup, Charles.
That's the setup. And it's something that you've addressed and we've addressed when we've talked about Job many, many times. We've written about Job.
Or Job, for those that aren't as familiar with.
Right. Not Steve.
No. He's dead.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so is Job.
Well,
He lived centuries ago.
Job could have never existed.
Well,
yeah.
You mean there's something metaphorical in the Bible?
Dum, dum, dum.
Oh, blasphemy.
It wouldn't be our podcast if we didn't.
Blaspheme, at least.
Sacrilegious.
So, that's our new tagline.
It should be. Hashtag this podcast is sacrilegious. So, what do you make of that? Well, have you encountered that within your own faith tradition and with your own struggles with mental illness?
Well, and that's why I went back and I actually prepared different notes and actually went back to what is the Jewish perspective on demons, you know, Jewish demonology. And surprisingly, there is...
Quick question.
Yeah.
Is this going to be more of a Talmud or Torah? Is this going to be scripture or interpretation?
No, this is Talmud. There's almost no mention of demonic things in Torah. Now, Hasatan is mentioned twice in Torah, but again, the Jewish understanding of Hasatan is not that
it's Hasatan not the Dante
is not
life.
Right. Is not Satan some being separate from God that is evil, and as Jenna Rebeck put it, you know, that's the visiting team and God's the home team. But that Hasatan is an angel, and the job of Hasatan is to oppose. And so in the story where Balaam, on the orders of Balak, is told to curse the Israelites, and he can't. Every time he tries to, he ends up blessing them. And in the passage says that when he went to speak, God put Hasatan in front of him, put an angel to oppose him.
Right.
Okay. And you know, in Kabbalah, the understanding of angels is that angels are created for a very specific reason by God, and they can only fulfill that reason, that purpose. It's their nature. They can't do anything else.
Right.
So they have no autonomy. So Hasatan does not simply oppose or obstruct because he's trying to destroy us. He opposes or obstructs because God instructs him to do that. You know, so you remove that. But any other demonology mainly comes from Talmud and from Kabbalah. So it is people. And it's an interesting glimpse into the times and cultures. Many of the rabbis from the Talmud are Eastern European and Middle Eastern. So you're talking about a milieu that already had traditions of supernatural and things like that.
Right. And in many faith traditions.
That's where it comes from.
There are parallels, at least in all three of the Abrahamic faiths, which that's not really that surprising when you say it.
But what's interesting, even though at different places there's some pretty well-formulated demonology, you know, with physical descriptions and things like that, it's the majority of the time that Talmudic rabbis speak of demons, it's as a metaphor, not as a literal, yes, there are demons and they're coming to destroy you.
And with the people worshiping, the congregation, as it were, would they understand this is a metaphor too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's part of our understanding of, you know, God is all. God is. Okay. It's not just that we believe in one God. We believe in a God who is one. So there is nothing that exists that is not of God.
Right.
So there aren't these separate evil things that exist outside of God.
Pancreator.
That try to oppress and oppose God and make us do terrible, horrible things.
It sounds like it's a cipher for, like, let's say demons, the devil made me do it, versus, right. No, I'm a horrible human being.
Right.
And
right. And yeah, so it becomes just a way of talking about it.
I'm sitting here trying, like, other than Saul, King Saul, trying to think of just instances, and in New Testament, I mean, there are unclean spirits, and there's, you know, I think the most famous would be the Gerasene demoniac.
Right.
But there's... I kind of would push that. I would think the early church would have been like, this is metaphor. They were still very Jewish at that point.
Yeah. And
or heavily influenced thereof by.
Yeah. And that's what the rabbis were getting at. Because for them, what they were trying, it's that human nature of trying to explain something. And so in Kabbalah and for some of the Talmudic rabbis, they see the world as having certain energies, particularly creative energies and life energies that come from the world of immanence and creation, where we find God. And we're the only ones who not only receive this energy, but we can also send it back to the world of formation, where the angels are, and even to the world of creation. We have abilities to create, okay? Like, we can create life as human beings.
Right. That makes a little... Otherwise, I'm thinking, like, and do you also study under a large or a small green, wizened-looking Jedi that speaks in...
No, it's not the energy that binds us and connects us, but there's this cycle of energy that flows from...
Creative potential.
Well, it's not just creative potential, but it's just these energies that this is how God... comes through the world to us. And when there's an interruption in that cycle, it's misused or it's wasted or somehow we interrupt how it's supposed to go, that's what the rabbis will then use the metaphor of a demon to explain that.
Why not just call it an interruption in that flow of energy? A moment of dissonance, maybe. I'm a very much...
Because minds work better using metaphor.
So they
think metaphorically, and it's a difficult enough concept to think about, you know, various worlds and powers. It's what they're trying to explain is that every action we take has impact.
Right.
Both good and bad. And so things we do can create, and things we can do...
Now see, that sounds very... common sense, natural, you know, every action has a reaction. Everything has an impact. Nothing happens in a vacuum.
Right.
In my house, nothing happens with a vacuum. So,
I'm
unless I'm
I love
using
summer,
it.
So I'm not getting into that. You know, so that when there's these things that go awry, you know, this is a person's deeds create worlds, order the cosmic array, and participate in the divine process of destruction and repair. So when that happens and doesn't work out, the rabbis say, well, you know, there's these, we can think of them as if they were demons. They don't say they are demons and they do this. They say we can think of it as that way. For example, probably the one that I've talked about the most and written about is the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov. The idea that there are two inclinations within
us. This is the one about the roosters and hens story you used to tell?
No.
There has to be a little evil to get...
Oh, well, yeah.
But okay, go ahead.
No,
sorry.
No.
Tune in next week to figure out what the fuck I was just mentioning.
Yeah. You'll be the only one. Not tuning in, but trying to figure it out.
Right.
No. The idea that we have the potential for good and bad.
Right.
And we have free will. So the rabbis say, well, think of your inclination to do bad as a spirit. okay, as a voice, a Yetzer Hara, leading you to do bad things. Think of the other as your Yetzer Tov, that voice telling you to do the right thing. And then they what they're really talking about, in the it's a metaphor for the Yetzer Hara is our natural animal instincts.
Right.
And our Yetzer Tov is the metaphor for our humanity.
So an id and superego?
In a way, yeah.
See, I need to tip my hand. Yeah. I am with, especially as a former, and who knows, I mean, it's quite possible a future behavioral health patient. Certainly someone that has lived with and is, works hard to not get depressed again or to get bad depressed again. I'm a deconstructionalist. I demythologize. I simplify. Mm-hmm. I concretize. And I often catch hell for that from other clergy. I mean, it's lovingly catching hell, but it. So I'm just putting my card out there on the table, or cards rather, which I didn't think you were going to have a problem with, because now you can get to riff on Derrida for the next 20 minutes.
So remember, the rabbis are doing this in like the first and second century.
So what about today? Is there any folk belief, or would you find Jews that have something akin to what I think mostly evangelical Pentecostal, or at least those with a bent that way in Christianity, would refer to as spiritual warfare? Yes, and I use my big scary voice. Maybe I think of a way to make that sound even more demonic. I can make it sound really demonic. I can.
Yeah.
I can. Okay. Spiritual warfare, it's huge. It's huge. Bigly.
Bigly.
Does that not sound satanic? Nine minutes in.
And of course the answer is yes and no.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
I don't even know why I bothered to ask that question. Right, if there's a Jew on the other side of the room, I was like, yes.
No. Meh. We do have a concept of possession. Yeah.
Are there Jewish exorcists then?
There have been people who have claimed to do that.
But it's not a thing. Yeah.
But again, because most Jews, even Kabbalists, understand this as metaphor.
Right.
For understanding, you know. In a sense, it's, you know, as a rationalist and reasonable person who believes in reason, I admit,
it's very reasonable of you.
Yeah, that, you know, everything can be explained, but doesn't mean that we as human beings have an explanation for everything.
Yeah, we do. 42.
Yeah. No, that's the ultimate answer to the ultimate question.
42. I used that in a lecture this week.
Excellent.
You've been proud of me.
Yeah. You know, there are things, as the great Bard said, you know, there are more things in heaven and on earth, Horatio, than can be imagined in your poor philosophy. You know, the rabbis did believe in magic and, you know, the human ability to create things. But there is this concept of a dybbuk. A dybbuk is a spirit, and it's usually the soul of someone who has passed. And it's somebody who wasn't a necessarily good or righteous person.
So hugely out of line, you would say.
Yes. And what they do is they will inhabit a host and control that person. The difference is in the evangelical demonic warfare, when someone is possessed, they're then used as an instrument by that demon to perform evil to others and to the world.
Right.
A dybbuk just makes this person do bad things and fuck themselves up.
So it's more, you're screwed, I'm not taking other people with me, per se.
Right. I'm not possessing you because I want you to go out and destroy the world. I'm possessing you so that somebody else gets screwed up the way I did.
So not quite. So you could look at addiction as a form of...
Right.
I mean,
Or mental health.
Well, if we don't allow for the your addiction or your mental illness...
Right, as a physical...
And it will impact others,
right. But if you're looking for the spiritual part of it, you know, a rabbi might say, well, you know, it may be a dybbuk. Yeah. We're not going to do an exorcism, but they would use that as a way of explaining to you how, you know, you have been taken over
right.
by this addiction. Okay, and it's one of those reasons why when we talked about suicide, one of the ways that rabbis have justified doing burials for people who've committed suicide is by saying that, well, they weren't themselves, because if they were, they would not have done this.
Right.
If they weren't sick.
So
and so they use it as it's a metaphor. So they may be using the language, but they're not using it in the same way. And then you do have the good version. You have the Iber, which is a righteous soul who has passed, who may want to continue this righteousness, and so they then also find a host. But they do that more to protect that person. Not that, again, that person does not become an instrument of good in the world.
Is this more of a, mainline's not the right word, but is this more a periphery belief within Judaism, or is this pretty much...
It depends on where you grew up.
Right.
Okay. In a lot more of the Haredi and Hasidic communities where they depend a lot more on their Judaism to explain the world, this would be common. For a lot of American, conservative Reform Jews, they're more, if I can't see it, touch it, or feel it. I will tell you, though, that I've had personal experience with this.
With Dybbuk's?
Actually, it turned out not to be a Dybbuk, but an Iber.
You're going to have to tell the story now.
I'm going to have to tell the story now. All right.
Which will give me a chance to continue to enjoy the...
Yeah. When Gail was about 6 weeks pregnant with our first child.
The good one?
No, the first one.
Oh, okay. Evan, I threw you under the bus. Your dad nearly threw Lee under the bus.
So they're both there together. No. You ask either one of them, they'll tell you they're my favorite, because they are.
Right.
Lee is my favorite firstborn. Of all the firstborn children I've had, Lee is my favorite.
That you're claiming on your taxes, yes. or have claimed on your taxes.
Yeah. And of my youngest children, Evan is the favorite. Now, so Gail was about 6 weeks pregnant. We hadn't discussed names or anything. And my mother passed. And so, as you know, in Ashkenazic Judaism, there's a tradition that you name children for a relative who has passed. So immediately we talked about, are we going to name this child for my mother?
Which rough passed. For Lee. Okay.
Well, no, had Lee been a girl, he would have been Leah Devorah.
Ah.
Okay. And he is named for my mother, Lee Daniel. Because
Lee, okay.
Lucille de Dorothea. Her Hebrew name was Leah Devorah. So he's Lee Daniel. There's also a Hasidic superstition and tradition that when someone passes, they will visit one member of the family shortly after the funeral. A few days after we finished sitting Shiva, one night my mother stood at the foot of my bed and told me not to worry about naming our child after her, that she would not take over that child.
Right.
Which I realized meant that she promised not to be a Dybbuk.
Don't be that the bumper sticker, really.
Yeah, don't be a Dybbuk. Come on, don't be a Dybbuk.
See,
three right. years later, okay, or 4 years later, I think Lee was four, we had some friends over and we're standing in their kitchen and Lee's there with us. And somehow the conversation got around to my mom. And this four-year-old child looks up at all the grown-ups and says, yeah, Grandma Lucille was a very beautiful lady.
Which, yeah.
And we said, oh, how do you know? And his response was, well, I've met her.
Which he hadn't.
Not.
In utero. Right.
But afterwards, as an Iber, she had been looking out for him as a child.
I see that. Yeah, I hear some of that, and what I'm just struck by within Christianity, there is, I could see a parallel, although not apples to apples, but in saints, in the more not the ones that are so much venerated, but the power of influence, and one could also, I guess, make it psychologically, cognitively speaking, bad of those who are part of our family. But when you're telling this story, it is clear that this is. This is in no way metaphoric for you.
No. This was a physical experience, and I have the clear memory of it. To this, and the the looks on the grown-ups who all, were all Jewish,
right,
when Lee said, yeah, because I've met her. You know, everyone was expecting, well, I've seen pictures. But his response, well, I've met her. There were very few people in the room who doubted it.
Right.
Yeah.
So when we take that to... so here...
So, you know, it is...
But see, that's a, I think that in that instance, that's a... Even if you dismissed it as not... It is being metaphoric. I don't see any of that as being in any way unhealthy. I imagine that was a very sacred and powerful moment.
Absolutely.
Just in hearing it, I could pick that up.
Yeah. Well, for Judaism, you know, the division, the divider between our world and the world of creation and the world of formation and immanence is permeable. Now, you know, yeah, Jews believe in angels. We don't believe angels are the souls of our loved ones who've passed and gone to heaven. We believe that they're specific creatures that God has created.
Right.
Like we are.
So,
but
something I miss.
Yeah.
Since the illness, since the depression, is my understanding of, and I'll just use my language, but it's not meant in any way as slight to anything you've said, or for that matter, others, is that what can be called maybe the supernatural or beyond rational or...
Right. There are more things in heaven and on earth.
Than your poor theology.
Poor philosophy, yeah.
Right. Is it was so dangerous for me, because I for instance, you know, and I had good family, and my mother, God bless her. I mean, it baffles me. A woman, she's a chemist. And yet when it comes to me with my mental illness, it wasn't the scientific that took the front. It was the spiritual. And some of that could be it's your kid.
Yeah.
And you're kind of at a loss for words. But I got healthier when I quit believing in there for a while. God, just to hell with all the spiritual stuff. You know, I was in my late 30s, and I'm still wondering, oh, something went bump in the night, and it's not just something went bump, not, oh, my God, there's a demon in my living room. No. And so I had to really cut off that part of my sort of mind. And I will say that without apology, I've been all the more healthy for being a deconstructionist on it. But I miss it. You know, this is not even in the same league as what you just shared, but like I missed, like in Halloween, just that, you know, watching a scary movie and just getting the willies. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing that really scares me is it's got to be something startling. It has to be just boom, right, you know, jumping out. Because I can sit and watch, you know, real life crime, surgery shows.
It's not just
I can work in ED. I don't think I'm desensitized, but it just doesn't, I don't know. And I kind of miss that. But at the same time, I really feel that the journey I'm on is going to arrive at a more full faith, but I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
And there's a longing for that transcendent and supernatural, transcendence, a better word, moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what the rabbis are trying to do. They're not trying to explain the natural world. They're trying to explain that there is a world beyond our world of action, and that we are connected to it, that what we do here influences not just here, but also influences that other world, and that we are connected to it. You know, so I had this is from Barachot, one of the books of Talmud, Abba Benjamin. Had the human eye been given the power of seeing them, no person could endure because of the evil spirits. Abai said, they outnumber us and surround us like the ridge around a field. Rabbi Huna said, every one of us has 1,000 on his left hand and myriads on his right. Rabba said, they crush at the public discourse. The crush of the public discourse is due to them. The knees grow fatigued because of them. The wearing out of clothes of the rabbis is the consequence of their rubbing against them. Their feet are bruised by them. Again, they're trying to say that yes, there is this other world beyond our perception and understanding. You know, we are not the only things God has ever created.
So, going back to the motif of health, when your story about Lee and your mother, I meant again, that seems very healthy, Even if you weren't, even if you weren't given to, you know, if it wasn't that you were a dear friend, I might say, well, if that's a way of coping with grief, then I'm not going to rob you of that moment because it's comforting.
Right.
But when I'm working a psych unit, people, I feel that I hurt people by letting the demon, and some of my colleagues would say, they would say the witch in the room, but that's another story entirely. I'm more like they don't exist. It's fiction. And I know, you know, that's probably going to get the hackles up on some people, but it's because it, when you think, or when I, and I'll just, okay, full disclosure, my own projection into this, is I walked into my church and I felt physically ill. And there were people that were well-meaning, but their faith was their primary metaphor, or lens rather, for looking at the world and explaining, making meaning. That, oh, it must be a demonic spirit, versus I'm really just not in an appointment that meets sort of my gifts and that congregation's needs. It's not a judgment on them. It's just the reality. And that maybe it was just that you were sick of working there, which, you know, when you get that whole Occam's razor type approach, makes a hell of a lot of sense. But if the dominant meta lens you interpret through is religion, that doesn't get on the table. And so I think that we rob people of agency when they're mentally ill. And so I go with the, well, let's deconstruct, or at least at least simplify and concretize. And if you want to pick up, going forward, a more robust or more transcendent, supernatural, or however you want to define it, fine. But it's sort of like, you know, you may enjoy running, but after you've broke your leg and the cast comes off, let's work with limping first. Can you triage spirituality? Yeah.
I think the problem is, like, when you're talking about that clinical situation, is, you know, what do I say is the greatest evil in the world? Binary oppositions.
Right, well,
when we make it a choice, it's one or the other. You know? And it's like you're saying, when the only choice is the spiritual, it removes the agency, and now the possible healing action is no longer on the table.
Right, because you've made the whatever is bothering you so far outside of your control.
Right.
That, you know, you just, I felt, and I found that others have felt, just helpless.
Well, yeah. Well, you know,
it's not empowering.
This might be a demon, and here's the serum and magic formula that's going to help you. So I want you to swallow this pill twice a day.
Which kind of pokes at the medical model, too.
Yeah, but it's making sure that they're getting their meds.
Right.
You know, because at some point, depending on where a person is, I can understand not necessarily humoring them, but if they're literally not in their rational mind.
Right.
Giving them a rational explanation is not going to work. Well, let me explain rationally what's going on in your head right now. That's not helpful either. What's helpful is getting them stabilized, getting them their meds.
By any means necessary?
Yeah.
My hackles went up.
Is the goal to get them better?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I'm not claiming you play into the delusion, but
how do you know when to stay with the delusion? Like, you know, if I'm treating you and you're there for your usual cardiac issues, and you say, like, God spoke to me today, chaplain, I'd be like, oh, great, Charles, that's wonderful.
And what did he say?
What did God say? And then, but if you're in the psych unit, and you say, God talked to me, I'm going to go look at your chart to make sure that you haven't had any other audio hallucinations.
Right. But when you also, well, what did God say to you?
Which is why not the binary? But right. I think for chaplains, we often fail on the side of being over-spiritual.
Did God mention that, you know, you need to get better, and so
God's talking to me, too. You need to do ECT.
No, not necessarily, but, you know, did you know, well, that's good. Well, your doctor spoke to me today and said that, you know, you skipped your meds this morning.
Right. I mean, it's, and I think what I've tried to do with more gentle approaches with folks, especially families, and this was before I went into chaplaincy, I was doing this, is that there's not necessarily one thing that's going to cure, and cure is always a problematic word.
Right.
There are many things that can help get you there, spirituality being one of them. And that's going to be a podcast, I know, in the future, is can we delineate what is a healthy spirituality? I know plenty of people that are in recovery from addictions that have a regimented and so regulated conservative faith that it would, I would be hospitalized, but they're clean and sober.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to take that away from them. Go with God. You're, that's a hell of a disease to fight to begin with.
But and if it helps you to believe God's on your side fighting for you.
All the more for it.
Yeah.
But, and yeah. And I mean, of course, with anything, when you're a chaplain, a minister, or whatever, is never overestimate your impact. Because, I mean,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, let's be realistic. You may have a great impact, but may not. But I've found that folks have been liberated by just the simple offering of them, like, what if you just let go of that for right now? And portraying it as sometimes to get a better grip on things, you have to let go to grab it again. And that God's, if God is anything like we think God is, God's not going to be upset by that. God's likely going to be going, the hell didn't you do that like fucking 10 years ago, man? Or,
ma'am? Well, it's, you know, the other great story, not buying the ticket, but the guy in the flood.
Right. Right, you know, God.
What the hell are you doing?
When did you provide? They said two boats and a helicopter.
Right, you idiot! What the hell are you doing here?
Right.
You know, I send you to a doctor.
Faith, you're stupid.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, but it there's got to be a way to express
unobservant. Unobservant is more realistic.
And I, you know, dealing with a scared child, for example.
Right.
Yeah. One of the first things you do is you don't say, well, there's no monsters yet. You know, you acknowledge
the fear.
The fear.
Right.
Okay. And then you deal with it. And I kind of think of it the same way. If someone is at that point that they're hospitalized, the rational, reasonable, scientific explanation of their symptoms isn't going to get through.
Right. Because that filter's set on.
Yeah. So you've got to, you know, it's. All right, my, you know, William James. All right, pragmatism. If you're talking about a filter,
was dead in moments.
That was his brother Henry.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
William was the philosopher.
Wait, I thought that was the one that was working on the railroad. That's John. That's John Henry. John Henry.
Yeah. Wow. That. Whew, really. I mean. You went really out of your way for that one.
I did.
Yeah. I mean, so much so you got lost.
I never, still not back. But William James.
William James. And you're talking about, you know, their filter. Yeah, that filter is designed to filter out certain things as well as to allow other things through. And,
you know, filter's not a wall.
Yeah. But, you know, when you talk about paradigms, the same kind of thing, that lens that you look through. By its nature, is going to limit things. So if you're talking about the you know, their filtering, trying to cram something through that filter that filter's designed to keep out is not helpful. You have to adjust. You have to change the filter.
So deconstruction could be a healthy filter in times.
Yeah. Yeah, but they have to be part of the process. You have to.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's autonomy. You know, you can't.
Yeah, you can't say, no, you can't use that filter. You have to look it through this one. And you can't just cram the information through. So, again, where do we blend the spiritual and the medical healing?
Right.
Because to me, they can complement. You know, that it can be a route in. Because if they're set up to only hear the spiritual, then make that the message, but the content is the medical.
So it's translating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, that I can add. That I'm learning to be more person-centered rather than solution-centered in my approaches.
Mm-hmm.
Which, because solution-centered definitely is somebody that's into CBT, it's kind of what it is.
Right.
But I'm learning to sit with people's stories. But I you can't rush somebody to healing, but it's just in acute care, you're wanting to, like, give them something that who knows, you know, that might be the one conversation that later on, you know, planted a seed and later on that germinates and they gain some agency back. They get some recovery, some healing.
And it's also, not to put this on you and destroy all the work you've been doing, but it's that perspective. You know it worked for you.
Which is not a... And that's all you can say.
Yeah, and you, so I know that consciously you don't impose that on others, but is there some of that unconsciously? Oh, yeah.
That's anybody.
Exactly.
With any any kind of illness.
Right, that's my point. So how much of your initial, well, you need to let go of the spiritual and see what this is rationally, is because that's how you dealt with it.
Oh, that's with anything. I don't think there's...
No, I'm not saying it's unique to you.
No, my point
is that you're not, sorry to break the sea, but you're not unique and special.
Oh, no. I'm Gen X. I knew that a long time ago. Do you want to put a pin in this one?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And we'll certainly be coming back to it, I'm sure, again and again. Because it is something that I don't think there's a solution. It is a worthwhile discussion. And you know, we invite those of you listening to post comments and be a part of this discussion.
Well, with various scriptural traditions, it's also always ask the question, well, why did the people that wrote this, what was their motivation? What's behind that text? And I think that's something that Judaism is better, I wouldn't say it's better equipped, it doesn't have the same problem. The fact that there's a Talmud, I mean, we've said this, Christianity doesn't, it does, unfortunately, such as spiritual warfare and dispensationalism and whatnot, but we don't acknowledge it in the same way mainstream, the way Judaism does, where you're raised on interpretation and both interpretation, commentary, and scripture on the table at the same time. Christianity does this weird thing that I've always had issues with, of I don't like study Bibles. Mm-hmm. And my preaching professor, Dr. Turner, Duke University. See, yeah, he got that in there before we got to the close.
That was close.
No, but he said
you were cutting it close.
He would always say, like, there's a healthy thing about I've got my Bible in one hand and I've got the commentary in my other separate other hand in a separate other book, because it cognitively points out that this is scripture, this is interpretation, and both need to be on the table.
Yeah, but that's why I do like, you know, like the Eighth Chaim and
versions
of Tanakh. So all the notes and things.
Let me finish it. Let me finish it this way: is there's not like a Jewish study Bible for the patriot soul, right?
No.
Right. And you know, I did this with youth, young adults, children, as they couldn't quote the scripture, but they could tell you about the really neat devotional, which is interpretation, that appeared near that scripture in the same book. Right. I'm like, well, no, that's interpretation. There are about 100 other ways you could have looked at that.
Yeah.
Well, I get why we have those things, because people will buy them.
Every page of Talmud, you know, has whatever Bible passage they're commenting on in the middle of it.
And
the commentary, if you look physically how Talmud is set up, you have in the center is the passage, and it may be three words, it may be several verses. And then surrounding it,
and more than one person's thought,
literally surrounding it, is the entire debate of rabbis across the centuries.
Rabbis,
yes,
that's that plural is so significant.
Yeah, surrounding it, and so you literally, the scripture is in the center.
No, and when we tend to do, like, well, I'm Lutheran, I'm going to read Luther. If I'm Calvinist, I'm Calvin. Right. Methodist, Wesley. I mean, we have our silos and bubbles, or whatever you want to call it, that we definitely surround ourselves with, and I'm certainly guilty of that. I don't know of anybody that's not. But we could get into, like, how capitalism has ruined spirituality, but that's another podcast entirely, right?
Absolutely.
So do you have anything brilliant to say today?
I do.
Or is it just going to be a total wash like usual?
No, we always end with something brilliant, because we end with somebody else's words of wisdom.
Well, we end is just brilliant for some people, I think.
Yeah. So, Longfellow.
I went to his house, but it was closed for rehabilitation. I'm like,
that's ironic.
I went to Harvard, or I guess Cambridge. We were touring Harvard. Mm-hmm. And I again, my wife was wearing an ECU sweatshirt. The guy at the universe, somebody on campus was like, "What's ECU?" I had my Duke one. I was like, okay, school. Okay. But at least he knew the school. So
Harvard of the South.
Harvard of the South. Right. But we went to the lawn because I love the Children's Hours, one of my favorite poems.
Yeah.
This is probably not from that.
No, this is not from that. But I thought it was appropriate. The spirit world around this world of sense floats like an atmosphere, and everywhere wafts through these earthly mists and vapors dense a vital breath of more ethereal air.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
And we invite you to join us next time when a Jew and a Gentile
walk into a bar mitzvah.
I've been kicking myself over.